Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with fiction writer Karen Russell about her new short story collection, Vampires in the Lemon Grove.
Oh my God, I think it would embarrass people, Sam. They'd be like, why didn't this story cure cancer if that's how much time you put into it, you know?
Leslie Kaufman has notes from the field. Adam Kirsch looks back at Sylvia Plath 50 years after her suicide.
You wouldn't read Sylvia Plath's poems and necessarily know what her life was like, except for the fact that her biography has also become so famous.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. Karen Russell is one of America's most accomplished and original young fiction writers. Her novel Swamplandia was a sensation. She has a new book. It's a collection of short stories called Vampires in the Lemon Grove. It's reviewed on our cover by Joy Williams, who says Karen Russell is a wildly talented young writer, and her work has a velocity and trajectory that is little less than dazzling. I'm delighted that Karen is joining us from Boston, I believe, to talk about her book. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, Sam. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I have to start off with a story that's of particular interest to me, and I think will be to many of our listeners, because we have just re-inaugurated a president. And that's your story about presidents as horses. How did you come up with this idea?
Oh, gosh. That's one of the earlier stories in the book, and I think it was I had just seen some documentary, one of these really reverential documentaries about the lives of the presidents with a lot of pompous voiceovers, you know, reading from their diaries, and the focus seemed to be on, you know, the interest of these men in their legacies, you know, how history would regard them. And at that time, I was living with my friend who's an equestrian who had a book called There Are No Problem Horses, Only Problem Riders. And I think somehow, I don't know why my brain combined the two, but I was thinking just about, you know, how vexing it would be to these men who had such a stake in their legacies to find themselves reborn in like a Kentucky afterlife that made even less sense than this planet, you know. So in the story, they're sort of reincarnated, and it's sort of the B-listers, you know, so it's Rutherford B. Hayes is the protagonist of that story, not a president who gets a lot of press these days. And I think just something about that, the absurdity of that setup as a way to think through an afterlife where things were just as bewildering, if not more so, than they are at this moment.
Well, it's the story is called The Barn at the End of Our Term. And one of the fascinating things about it is you've chosen 11 presidents, and as you say, B-listers, although Eisenhower is kind of rising.
And Adam, sure, there's some storied dudes in there, too.
What you have done, though, by making them these horses is actually give us a way, there's a great deal of historical knowledge in this, of kind of understanding who they were and how ephemeral that legacy is, how it almost becomes as invented as the situation you've created for them.
Right, what that would look like from the vantage point of this kind of strange antechamber. That it really would seem so misty and remote and exactly very ephemeral.
Now, Karen, tell us also about the title story, Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Who is this vampire who tells us the story?
I was on a trip to Sorrento, and I saw this small Italian grandfather drinking lemonade. He appeared to be sucking on a lemon. This was in some Sorrento lemon grove like years ago. And he looked a lot like a tan vampire to me. And so that's the very humble and kind of doofus origin of this story, where I was thinking about what would it be like if lemons were a kind of vampire methadone or a vampire analgesic. You know, there's somebody who's kind of in recovery trying to give up, you know, their bloodier impulses, and they found sort of a temporary fix, and they're just in this purgatorial space. I think a lot of the stories in this collection feature monsters or, you know, human or otherwise, in these purgatorial spaces. So in this case, this guy, he's discovered he doesn't need to drink blood, but he hasn't found a much better lasting solution. It's such a kind of a goofy setup, but I was thinking about it as a way to really think about addiction. And his marriage has kind of hit a sour patch in this lemon grove as well. He's married to another vampire. they're both sucking on these lemons, and they're sort of having some disputes about, you know, what kind of future they want to have together in their eternal lives as a couple.
Something that struck me about that particular story, because I'm an Italophile myself and have been to Sorrento, is, you know, a little bit of Italian. You have a feel for Italian culture. And our reviewer, Joy Williams, says, too, that one of the real pleasures of your stories and your prose is that while the situation, the setup or donné may seem very bizarre, it's actually told in a very precise way with very exact observations of people and situations and settings and events. And it makes me wonder if it's in some way liberating to wholly invent an alien sort of universe and in that way describe the things you really see and observe in daily life.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's exactly the name of that pleasure, where you can have naturalistic details that you really try to keenly see in this imaginary world. And hopefully, you know, there's that great Flannery O'Connor quote, the truth is not distorted here, but rather a distortion is used to get at truth. So for me, I think it always does feel really freeing and playful and exciting, but also that's a space where I feel like it can be more honest about, you know, something about human nature, something about the world that we reside in, sort of through distortion. You know, there's this funny way, it's like it's a funhouse mirror. You can see certain aspects of reality more clearly, you know, or you know, describe them as joyfully and precisely as possible.
Well, you know, it reminds me of something that a great contemporary of Flannery O'Connor, Saul Bellow, also said. I think it's in Humboldt's Gift. If there are mysterious forces around us, we need to exaggerate in order to see them.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I want to plagiarize that. That's great.
A question, too. Here you're starting a very brilliant career as a really major writer. You're doing short stories and the novel. A number of people have pointed out a lot of really fine writers now. You're one example. George Saunders is another. Tom Perotta is a third. Are turning back to the short story. What's the particular satisfaction of the short story, apart from the fact that it doesn't take as long to write, maybe, as a novel?
I mean, and that's, let's not discount that. That is kind of a great pleasure, right? That you're not tithing, you know, half a decade of your life, you know, to a novel. Thank you so much for including me on that list. You know, George Saunders is a hero of mine, and it's so exciting to see what's happening for him now. And I think he's sort of at the frontier of, you know, of fiction, American fiction, and doing something completely original and new with the short form. You know, for me, the pleasure in a collection like this, I loved writing Swamplandia, but it felt really liberating and exciting to return to stories, because you can take different kinds of risks, you know, and I think that they can work the way a poem works. You can compass meaning, and you can have like an elliptical sort of emotional logic. You can really focus on the micro pleasure of a line in a way that maybe is more difficult or not as suited to the longer form. You can deliver a really dense emotional punch, I think, in a story. And for readers, I love reading short stories because you can read them in one sitting. You know, you can have this sort of single, seamless dream experience, you know, sort of the waking dream of a story. You're not sort of interrupting it. You're not reading it over the course of weeks. It's sort of a spell, a pocket spell you can cast on yourself.
And yet, at the same time, really fine stories like yours are so carefully honed. As you say, every sentence is so important. Joy Williams writes that your voice is tough, enveloping, exhilarating, can't be equaled by another writer. How many drafts are you putting your stories through?
Oh, my God, I think it would embarrass people, Sam. They'd be like, why didn't this story cure cancer if that's how much time you put into it? You know, I think in some cases in this collection, there's stories that I sort of conceived of them, and it would take, you know, a year of gestation and revision. And I was lucky enough to work with wonderful magazine editors on a lot of these. And I think, you know, it would embarrass people to look at my desktop, you know, like the umpteenth draft of some of these guys. I can't tell you how much it meant to me to be reviewed by Joy Williams, because I think, like George Saunders, she's someone who can take the short form and just extend forever the horizon of what you thought fiction could do. Just really knock people loose from their kind of the way that you've become inured to seeing everyday reality, and just open up a new vista in the short form. And she can do it, you know, in 12 pages. just dynamite open an entirely new way of seeing. So it was wonderful to get to be reviewed by her.
Well, congratulations again, and we'll all be looking forward to the next book from you, Karen Russell. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you so much.
That was Karen Russell, whose new book, Vampires in the Lemon Grove, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Leslie Kaufman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Leslie.
Hello, Sam.
So one of the most beloved and wonderful novels of all time.
Absolutely.
Pride and Prejudice, approaching its 200th anniversary.
Unbelievable.
And there's an unusual story you have to tell about it.
Yeah. Well, what's great about Pride and Prejudice is I love the novel. Everyone loves the novel. It still feels weirdly relevant even today. But what's interesting is modern authors are always trying to take a piece of it. You'll remember P.D. James recently had a bestseller with Death at Pemberley, which is about a murder that takes place at Darcy's mansion about 10 years into Elizabeth and Darcy's happy marriage. I just read that. That was very fun. But all of Britain is excited about a new book coming out. It's called Longbourn, and it's about the servants at Longbourn. Their perspective, it maps on perfectly to Pride and Prejudice, but it's from below downstairs.
Now, Longbourn is which house? Is that the one where Elizabeth Bennet meets Darcy, or is that her own home?
That is the Bennet home. That is the Bennet home. That's where the five girls grow up. And in this story, you'll get the servant's perspective of what it's like to dress Jane from the ball, what it's like to bring the notes from Mr. Binkley, and what the servants must have thought when that silly Lydia ran off with that evil Mr. Wickham.
Oh, that's right. Right. He's the captain or something in the army, and she runs off with him.
She runs off with him without being married.
Yes.
That ridiculous Lydia.
And at a very young age.
At a very young age, yes.
And do we know anything about the author, about the novelist?
We do. I think what made everyone so excited, the woman's name is Jo Baker, and she has written four previous novels, only one of which came to the United States. I believe that's The Undertow, and that was published by Knopf. And she's gotten recognition. I actually think she was a New York Times recommended new novelist, something along those lines. But she hasn't sold very well or been very popular. And often in publishing, those authors are very hard to keep in the mix, right? They lose their momentum. But she's got an agent who never gave up, Claire Alexander. When this proposal came, it went like fire through England. By Monday, she had sold the American rights. By Tuesday, she had sold the British rights to Doubleday. By Thursday, she had a film deal. Focus Features will do it, along with Random House. And now she has 8 foreign translations, all in a week. It's just a tremendous sale for a novelist like this.
Well, it's a really heartening story, because what one hears so often from publishers is they're hoping for the breakthrough novel by the really fine writer. And this seems to be an instance of that.
Well, there's people who've read it are certainly excited. I'm sort of excited just by the possibility.
Thanks so much, Leslie.
Thanks, Sam.
We are fast approaching, it's hard to believe, the 50th anniversary of Sylvia Plath's suicide. There are 2 new books about her, American Isis, The Life and Art of Sylvia Plath by Carl Rollison, and Mad Girl's Love Song, Sylvia Plath and Life Before Ted by Andrew Wilson. They're both reviewed for us by one of America's most distinguished and admired and prolific young critics. Adam Kirsch is here to talk about it. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's start. You know everything about poetry. You write poetry. You're a poetry critic in many distinguished publications, including ours. What do we think of Plath today as a poet?
I think that she ranks pretty high as a poet. I mean, she's always had a reputation as being maybe a young person's poet, someone who writes about very dramatic emotions, and her legend as a suicide has always played into her reputation.
As a young person herself, they're 30 years old or something.
Exactly. She was only 30 when she died. Most of her great poems were written when she was 29. She never got to have the sort of mature period that most poets have. But I think that strictly in literary terms, that she ranks very high. She's really a very powerful, very distinctive poet, very revolutionary in certain ways. She uses surrealism in a way that no one else does to great effect. And she's someone who's really lasting.
And Adam, is it fair to say that she was one of the figures, along with someone, her elder, like Robert Lowell, who introduced this very powerful confessional autobiographical aspect of poetry?
Definitely. I mean, when you think of confessional poets, you think of Robert Lowell and John Berryman, but especially Sylvia Plath. The irony of that is that she wasn't really confessional in the same way as those other poets. With Lowell and Berryman, they often write about things that are happening in their lives. They use proper names. They talk about where they live, what they're doing from day to day. There's a book by Robert Lowell called Day by Day. Plath is not like that at all. She writes about herself in very mythical terms, and she cast herself as a series of mythical figures, as Lady Lazarus, as someone who eats men like air. You wouldn't read Sylvia Plath's poems and necessarily know what her life was like, except for the fact that her biography has also become so famous.
Well, and let's talk a little bit about that life. What was her background? Where was she from?
She was born in Massachusetts, in eastern Massachusetts. Her father, Otto, who she writes about famously in the poem Daddy as a sort of nightmare figure, was a German immigrant. Her mother, also a German immigrant family. And her father died when she was a child. And so she was raised by a single mother along with her brother. And one of the things that these biographies really bring out well is how poor she was and how money was always an issue for her growing up and an issue for her as she started her career as a writer. That was especially acute when she got to Smith as a student, where most of the students were quite well off and she had to work the whole time she was there to support herself. It really affected the way she thought about writing. She always wanted to make money from her writing. She was always interested in writing for places like 17, Mademoiselle, where you wouldn't necessarily think a great genius poet is going to be writing.
And in fact, she did have a connection with those magazines.
She did, absolutely. She published short stories in them. She was consistently interested throughout her life in publishing stories and places like that. And of course, famously, as she wrote about in the Bell Jar, she worked for a summer at Mademoiselle as one of the student editors.
Now, Adam, the second book here, Mad Girl's Love Song, Sylvia Plath and Life Before Ted. Ted is Ted Hughes.
Right. There's a certain novelty in this approach that when you think of Sylvia Plath, what's most famous about her today is probably her marriage to Ted Hughes, who was also a great poet and with whom she had a famously stormy relationship.
And he was English.
He was English. She met him when she was at Cambridge on a Fulbright in the mid-1950s. They got married very quickly after knowing each other for just a few months. They had a great romance, and then it all sort of fell apart. And at the time she died, they were in the process of divorcing. That left the ironic result that this man who she had grown very estranged from and who became sort of a villain in her work was left in control of her literary estate. And it was Ted Hughes who was responsible for editing and publishing her poems and journals and letters. And that generated a lot of biographical conundrums. This is something that Janet Malcolm wrote about in her great book, The Silent Woman.
Now, Adam, it's almost impossible to talk about Sylvia Plath, especially if you're someone of a certain generation. That's me, not you. Without some reference to feminism. She is one of still the great sort of beacons of modern American feminism. Why is that?
Well, I think that's definitely still part of her legacy, and that's something I talk about in the review, is that she grew up before the sexual revolution, really sort of on the cusp of it. She died in 1963, so just before the 60s were getting underway. One thing that Mad Girl's Love Song brings out very well is what it was like to be a very ambitious, intelligent, personally powerful woman growing up in 1950s America, and how ugly were the things that she had to deal with men, the expectations men had of her, the way that she felt she had to present herself in order to be appealing. She had to restrain and sublimate so much of her energy, including her sexual energy. One reason why she was drawn to Ted Hughes is that he was someone who was as strong as she was. She didn't feel that she had to restrain herself around him. But with many of the men who she dated before, she really did have to put on this nice girl demeanor. And one of the things that makes her poetry, her best poetry, so powerful is that it represents her destroying all of that imagery, destroying these feminine myths, and emerging as someone who is more powerful, more violent than those images can contain.
Thanks so much, Adam.
My pleasure.
That's Adam Kirsch, who reviews two biographies of Sylvia Plath in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, Sam.
So what's new on the lists this week?
Well, on the hardcover fiction list, starting at number 16, Charles Todd has a new book, Proof of Guilt. That's part of his Ian Rutledge detective series. Then at number 12, the new Dave Barry, Insane City, which is kind of a wedding romp of a novel. He's collaborated on a lot of novels over the last few years, but this is his first standalone novel for adults going back 10 years or more.
Can we stop right here? I think my distinguished colleague, Greg Coles, has just coined a brilliant term, standalone novel. I love this. Bring Proust and Tolstoy into the room. They might not know what you mean. But for our moment, perfect. Onward.
Proust might not know what I mean. At number 8, we have Alan Bradley, Speaking from Among the Bones. Then at number 7, Sister Souljah, the former rapper who rose to fame when Bill Clinton criticized her in 1992. Shortly after that, she started a career as a writer. And this is her fourth novel. It's called A Deeper Love Inside, and it makes its debut on the list at number 7. She writes this kind of urban lit genre. And then the last new book on the fiction side of things is new at number 1 by Danielle Steele, Until the End of Time.
Danielle, we love her, our podcast guest. Good for her. Now, what about nonfiction?
Over on nonfiction, there are 4 new books. At number 13, Paul Kennedy, the historian who wrote The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers, he's done a lot of war history, is back at it with a book called Engineers of Victory. It looks at kind of the middle ranks of people on the Allied side in World War II, the engineers and scientists and inventors who executed the generals and politicians' strategies and made it possible to win. Everyone always talks about German engineering, you know, how great the Germans were at getting the trains to run on time and all like that. But Kennedy here looks on the Allied side and says, really, there was a lot of innovation, kind of new radar technology, things like that.
So American and British mainly?
Yes, exactly so. That really enabled the Allies to execute their plan and roll to victory.
Well, I have to say it's cheering. Paul Kennedy's a major historian. It's cheering to see that book on the bestseller list. That's a surprise to me, at least.
Then at number 7, Al Gore has a book called The Future.
You know what I just said? I take it back.
He is kind of looking at the current state of the world and where we're going to go from here. He looks again at global warming and sustainability and argues for what we need to do to address 6 major problems that he identifies. And then new at number 4 and at number 3 are 2 books, both about pop music. New at number 4, the great gospel singer Sissy Houston, who is the mother of Whitney Houston, has a kind of a tell-all memoir out about her daughter. Whitney, of course, died just about a year ago, the night before the Grammys in Los Angeles. This memoir is called Remembering Whitney, and it's talks about her as a child. It talks about her struggles with drug and alcohol addiction. It looks at her marriage, goes into some of the gossip about her life, and it goes through all the way to her death. And then at number 3, Tommy Mottola, who is the former head of Sony Music.
And wasn't he married to Mariah Carey?
He was married to Mariah Carey. He kind of made Mariah Carey. He was both celebrated and also derided as kind of a Svengali figure in Mariah Carey's life. By the time that she left him, she claimed to feel like a prisoner in that marriage. They had a big
– gigantic estate somewhere.
Yeah, out in Bedford in Westchester County. And by the time that she left, she was calling that estate Sing Sing after the prison. She was only 18 when they met. He was 40 and already running things at – I'm not sure if it was Sony yet or if it was still CBS, but he was already the head of the label. And he recognized what a great voice she had and said, you know, she's going to be a star.
Star is born.
Yeah. And so this is a memoir called Hitmaker. It looks at a lot more than just the Mariah Carey years. Mottola himself started out as a singer for CBS back in like the early 60s. He went by the name T.D. Valentine, came out with a single, didn't do much in his music career as a singer, but he went on to manage musicians. He his first big clients were Hall & Oates, and he really was responsible for their success. And then as a manager, he was hired away to CBS, where he eventually climbed to the top and is responsible for a lot of careers, Celine Dion, the Dixie Chicks, Mariah Carey, obviously, Gloria Estefan. He's really got his fingerprints all over the music industry, especially for the 90s and early 2000s.
Well, both those memoirs actually sound quite interesting. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our show is produced by John Williams and Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can write to us at books@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.